Probably right. If you sincerely want to hear all about what is wrong with you and what you ought to do to rectify it, all you need to do is let them in-laws on the place. You'll get a complete rundown on the subject, and I guarantee it. She ain't got no family. That's good, said Orrin. That's your smartest move yet. After Orrin had gone, he sat over his coffee a long time. Through the window, far to the south, he could see the thin white adder's tongues of lightning licking silently along the rim of the sky in the darkness over Mexico. The only sound was the clock ticking in the hallway. When he entered the barn, Billy's light was still on. He went down to the stall where he kept the pup and gathered it up, all twisting and whimpering in the crook of his arm, and brought it back to his bunk room. He stood at the door and looked back. Good night, he called. He pushed aside the curtain and felt overhead in the dark for the light switch chain. Good night, called Billy. He smiled. He let go the chain and sat on his bunk on the darkness, rubbing the pup's belly. He could smell the horses. The wind was gusting up, and a piece of loose roofing tin at the far end of the barn rattled, and the wind passed on. It was cold in the room, and he thought to light the little kerosene heater, but after a while he just pulled off his boots and trousers and put the pup in his box and crawled under the blankets. The wind outside and the cold in the room were like those winter nights on the North Texas plains when he was a child in his grandfather's house. When the storms blew down from the north and the prairie land about the house stood white in the sudden lightning and the house shook in the thunderclaps. On just such nights and just such mornings in the year he'd gotten his first colt, he'd wrap himself in his blanket and go out and cross to the barn, leaning into the wind, the first drops of rain slapping at him hard as pebbles, moving down the long barn bay like some shrouded refugee among the sudden slats of light that stood staccato out of the parted board walls, moving through those serried and electric prosceniums where they flared white and fugitive across the barn row on row until he reached the stall where the little horse stood waiting and unlatched the door and sat in the straw with his arms around its neck till it stopped trembling. He would be there all night, and he would be there in the morning when Arturo came to the barn to feed. Arturo would walk with him back to the house before anyone else was awake, brushing the straw from his blanket as he walked beside him, not saying a word. As if he were a young lord, as if he were never to be disinherited by war and war's machinery. All his early dreams were the same. Something was afraid, and he had come to comfort it. He dreamed it yet. And this, standing in the room in the black suit, tying the new black tie he wore to his grandfather's funeral on the cold and windy day of it. And standing in his cubicle in Mac McGovern's horse barn on another such day, in the cold dawn before work, in another such suit, the two halves of the box it came in lying on the bunk, with the crepe tissue spilling out, and the cut string lying beside it on the bunk, together with the knife he'd cut it with that had belonged to his father, and Billy standing in the doorway watching him. He buttoned the coat and stood, his hands crossed at the wrist in front of him. His face pale in the glass of the little mirror he'd propped on one of the 2x4s that braced the rough stud wall of the room. Pale in the light of the winter that was on the country. Billy leaned and spat in the chaff and turned and went out down the barn bay and crossed to the house for breakfast. The last time he was to see her was in the same corner room on the second floor of the Dos Mundos. He watched from the window and saw her pay the driver, and he went to the door so that he could watch her come up the stairs. He held her hands while she sat half breathless on the edge of the bed. ¿Estás bien? He said.
Sí, she said. Creo que sí.
He asked, was she sure she had not changed her mind?
No, she said. ¿Y tú?
Nunca.
¿Me quieres?
Para siempre. ¿Y tú?
Hasta el fin de mi vida.
Pues eso es todo. She said that she had tried to pray for them, but that she could not.
¿Por qué no? No sé. Creí que Dios no me oiría.
Él oirá. Reza el domingo.
Dile que es importante.
They made love and lay with her curled against him and not moving but breathing very quietly against his side. He did not know if she was awake, but he told her the things about his life that he had not told her. He told her about working for the hacendado at Cuatro Cienegas, and about the man's daughter, and the last time he saw her, and about being in the prison in Saltillo, and about the scar on his face that he had promised to tell her about and never had. He told her about seeing his mother on stage at the Majestic Theater in San Antonio, Texas, and about the times that he and his father used to ride in the hills north of San Angelo, and about his grandfather and the ranch and the Comanche Trail that ran through the western sections, and how he would ride that trail in the moonlight in the fall of the year when he was a boy, and the ghosts of the Comanches would pass all about him on their way to the other world again and again, for a thing once set in motion has no ending in this world until the last witness has passed. The shadows were long in the room before they left. He told her that the driver, Gutierrez, would pick her up at the café in La Calle de Noche Triste and take her to the other side. He would have with him the documents necessary for her to cross. Todo está arreglado, he said. She held his hands more tightly. Her dark eyes studied him. He told her that there was nothing to fear. He said that Ramon was their friend and that the papers were arranged and that no harm would come to her.
Él te recogerá a las 7 por la mañana. Tienes que estar ahí en punto.
Estaré ahí.
Quédate adentro hasta que él llegue.
Sí, sí.
No le digas nada a nadie.
No, nadie.
No puedes traer nada contigo.
Nada.
Nada.
Tengo miedo, she said.
He held her.
Don't be afraid, he said.
They sat very quietly. Down in the street, the vendors had begun to call. She pressed her face against his shoulder.
¿Hablan los sacerdotes español? She said.
Sí, ellos hablan español.
Quiero saber, she said, si creéis hay perdón de pecados.
He opened his mouth to speak, but she put her hand to his lips.
Lo que crees en tu corazón, she said.
He stared past her dark and shining hair toward the deepening dusk in the streets of the city. He thought about what he believed and what he did not believe. After a while, he said that he believed in God, even if he was doubtful of men's claims to know God's mind, but that a God unable to forgive was no God at all.
¿Cualquier pecado?
Cualquier, sí.
¿Sin excepción de nada?
She pushed her hand against his lips a second time. He kissed her fingers and took her hand away.
Con la excepción de desesperación, he said. Para eso no hay remedio.
Lastly, she asked if he would love her all his life, and she'd have touched her fingers to his mouth, but he held her hand.
No tengo que pensarlo, he said.
Sí.
Para toda mi vida.
She took his face in her hands and kissed him.
Te amo, she said. Y seré tu esposa.
She rose and turned and held his hands.
Debo irme, she said.
He stood and put his arms around her and kissed her there in the darkening room. He would have walked her down the hallway to the head of the stairs, but she stopped him at the door and kissed him and said goodbye. He listened to her steps in the stairwell. He went to the window to watch for her, but she must have gone along the street beneath him because he could not see her. He sat on the bed in the empty room and listened to the sounds of all that alien commerce in the world outside. He sat a long time, and he thought about his life and how little of it he could ever have foreseen, and he wondered, for all his will and all his intent, how much of it was his own doing. The room was dark, and the neon hotel sign had come on outside, and after a while he rose and took his hat from the chair by the bed and put it on and went out and down the stairs. At the intersection, the cab stopped. A small man with a black crepe armband stepped into the street and raised his hand, and the cab driver took off his hat and set it on the dashboard. The girl leaned forward to see. She could hear trumpets muted in the street, the clop of hooves. The musicians who appeared were old men in suits of dusty black. Behind them came the pallbearers, carrying upon their shoulders a flower-strewn pallet. Wreathed among those flowers, the pale face of a young man newly dead. His hands lay at his sides, and he jostled woodenly on his cooling board there, astride the shoulders of his bearers, and the wild notes from the dented gypsy horns carried back from the glass of the storefronts they passed, and back from the old mud or stuccoed facades, and a clutch of women in black rebozos passed, weeping, and children, and men in black or with black armbands, and among them, led by the girl, the blind maestro, shuffling with his small steps and look of pained wonder. Behind them came two mismatched horses drawing to a weathered wooden cart, and in the bed of it, unswept of its straw and chaff, a wooden coffin box of hand-planed boards, pinned with wooden trunnels and no nails to it, like some Sephardic box of old, and the wood blacked by scorching it, and the blacking sealed with beeswax and lamp oil, so that save for the faint wood grain of it, it looked like a thing of burnished iron. Behind the cart came a man bearing the coffin lid, and he carried it upon his back like death's penitent, and his clothes and he were blackened with it, wax or no. The cab driver crossed himself silently. The girl crossed herself and kissed the tips of her fingers. The cart rattled past, and the spoked wheels diced slowly the farther street side and the solemn watchers there, a card fan of sorted faces under the shop fronts, and the long skeins of light in the street broken in the turning spokes, and the shadows of the horses tramping upright and oblique before the oblong shadows of the wheels shaping over the stones and turning and turning. She put up her hands and pressed her face into the musty back of the cab seat. She sat back, one hand over her eyes and her face averted into her shoulder. Then she sat bolt upright with her arms beside her and cried out, and the driver wrenched himself around in the seat.
Señorita, he said, señorita.
The ceiling of the room was of concrete and bore the impression of the boards used to form it, the concrete knots and nail heads and the fossil arc of the circle saw's blade from some mountain sawmill. There was a single sooty bulb that burned there with a grudging orange light and a miller moth that patrolled it in random clockwise orbits. She lay strapped to a steel table. The steel was cold against her back through the short white shift she wore. She looked at the light. She turned her head and looked at the room. After a while, a nurse came in through the gray metal door, and she turned her stained and dirty face toward her.
Por favor,
she whispered.
Por favor.
The nurse loosed the straps and smoothed her hair back from her face and said she would return with something for her to drink. But when the door closed, she sat upright on the table and climbed down. She looked for some place where they might have put her clothes, but save for a second steel table against the far wall, the room was empty. The door, when she opened it, led to a long green corridor, dimly lit and stretching away to a closed door at the end. She went down the corridor and tried the door. It opened onto a flight of concrete steps, a rail of metal pipe. She descended three flights and exited into the darkened street. She did not know where she was. At the corner, she asked a man for directions to El Centro, and he stared at her breasts and continued to do so even as he spoke. She set out along the broken sidewalk. She watched the paving for glass or stones. The car lights that passed fetched her slight figure up onto the walls in enormous dark transparency, with the shift burned away and the bones all but showing, and then passing cast her reeling backwards to vanish once more into the dark. A man pulled up in a car and drove beside her and talked to her in low obscenities. He pulled ahead and waited. She turned into a dirt alley between two buildings and crouched, shivering, behind some battered steel oil drums. She waited a long time. It was very cold. When she went out again, the car was gone and she went on. She passed a lot where a dog lunged at her silently along a fence and then stood in the fence corner, shrouded in its own breath, silently watching her go. She passed a darkened house and a yard where an old man, also in nightclothes, stood urinating against a mud wall, and these two nodded silently to each other across the darkened space like figures met in a dream. The sidewalk gave out, and she walked on in the cold sand along the roadside and stopped from time to time to stand tottering while she picked the little goathead burrs from the soles of her bleeding feet. She kept the haze of light from the city before her, and she walked a long time. When she crossed the Boulevard de 16 de Septiembre, she kept her arms folded tightly at her bosom and her eyes lowered in the glare of the headlights, crossing half-naked in a hooting of car horns like some tattered phantom routed out of the ordinal dark and hounded briefly through the visible world to vanish again into the history of men's dreams. She went on through the barrios north of the city, along the old mud walls and the tin sides of warehouses, where the sand streets were lit only by the stars. Someone was singing on the road a song from her own childhood, and she soon passed a woman walking toward the city. They spoke good evening, each to each, and passed on. But the woman stopped and turned and called after her. "A donde va?" she called.
"A mi casa?"
The woman stood quietly. The girl asked, "Do I know you?" But the woman said that she did not. She asked the girl if this were her barrio, and the girl said that it was, and the woman then asked her how could it be that she did not know her. When she did not answer, the woman came slowly back down the road toward her.
"¿Qué pasó?"
she said.
"Nada."
"Nada," the woman said. She walked in a half circle around her, where she stood shivering with her arms crossed over her breasts, as if to find some favored inclination in the blue light of the desert stars by which she would stand revealed for who she truly was.
"Eres del White Lake," she said.
The girl nodded.
"Y regresas?"
"Sí."
"¿Por qué?"
"No sé."
"¿No sabes?"
"No."
"¿Quieres ir conmigo?"
"No puedo."
"¿Por qué no?"
She didn't know. The woman asked her again. She said that she could come with her and live in her house where she lived with her children. The girl whispered that she did not know her.
"¿Te gusta tu vida por allá?"
the woman said.
"No. Ven conmigo."
She stood shivering. She shook her head no. The sun was coming soon. In the dark above them a star fell, and in the cold wind before the dawn papers loped and clutched and rattled briefly in the spines of the roadside growth and loped on again. The woman looked toward the desert sky to the east. She looked at the girl. She asked the girl if she was cold, and she said that she was. She asked her again,
"¿Quieres ir conmigo?"
She said that she could not. She said that in 3 days' time the boy she loved would come to marry her. She thanked her for her kindness. The woman raised the girl's face in her hand and looked at her. The girl waited for her to speak, but she only looked into her face as if to remember her, perhaps to read at second hand the shapes of the roads that had led her to this place, what was lost or what was ruined, whom bereft, or what remained.
"¿Cómo se llama?"
the girl said, but the woman did not answer. She touched the girl's face and took away her hand and turned and went on along the dark of the road out of the darkened barrio and did not look back. Eduardo's car was gone. She crept shivering along the alley under the warehouse wall and tried the door, but it was locked. She tapped and waited and tapped again. She waited a long time. After a while, she went back out to the street, her breath pluming in the light along the corrugated wall. She looked back down the alley again and then went around to the front of the building and through the gate and up the walkway. The portress with her painted face seemed unsurprised to see her standing there, clutching herself in the stenciled shift. She stepped back and held the door, and the girl entered and thanked her and went on through the salon. Two men standing at the bar turned to watch her. Pale and dirty waif drifted by mischance in from the outer cold to cross the room with eyes cast down and arms crossed at her breasts, leaving bloody footprints in the carpet as if a penitent had passed. He seemed to have dressed with care for the occasion, although it may have been that he had business elsewhere in the city. He slid back the gold-linked cuff of his shirt to consult his watch. His suit was of light gray silk shantung, and he wore a silk tie of the same color. His shirt was a pale lemon yellow, and he wore a yellow silk handkerchief in the breast pocket of the suit, and the low-cut black boots with the zippers up the inner sides were freshly polished, for he left his shoes outside his door several pair at a time, as if the whorehouse hallway were a Pullman car. She sat in the saffron-colored robe he'd given her, upon the antique bed where her feet did not quite reach the floor. She sat with her head bowed so that her hair cascaded over her thighs, and she sat with her hands placed on the bed at either side of her as if she might be afraid of falling. He spoke in reasoned tones the words of a reasonable man. The more reasonably he spoke, the colder the wind in the hollow of her heart. At each juncture in her case, he paused to give her space in which to speak. But she did not speak, and her silence only led inexorably to the next succeeding charge, until that structure which was composed of nothing but the spoken word, and which should have passed on in its very utterance and left no trace or residue or shadow in the living world, that bodiless structure stood in the room a ponderable being, and within its phantom corpus was contained her life. When he was done, he stood watching her. He asked her what she had to say. She shook her head. "Nada," he said.
"No," she said. "Nada."
"¿Qué crees que eres?"
"Nada."
"Nada. Sí. ¿Pero piensas que has traído una dispensa especial a esta casa? ¿Que Dios te ha escogido?"
"Nunca creí tal cosa."
He turned and stood looking out the small barred window, along the limits of the city, where the roads died in the desert in sand washes and garbage dumps, out to the white perimeters at midday, where smoke from the trash fires burned along the horizon like the signature of vandal hordes come in off the inscrutable wastes beyond. He spoke without turning. He said that she had been spoiled in this house because of her youth. He said that her illness was illness only, and that she was a fool to believe in the superstitions of the women of the house. He said that she was twice a fool to trust them, for they would eat her flesh if they thought it would protect them from disease, or secure for them the affections of the lover of whom they dreamt, or cleanse their souls in the sight of the bloody and barbarous god to whom they prayed. He said that her illness was illness only, and that it would so prove itself when at last it killed her, as it soon would do. He turned to study her, the slope of her shoulders, and their movement with the rise and fall of her breath, the blood beat in the artery of her neck. When she looked up and saw his face, she knew that he had seen into her heart. What was so, and what was false? He smiled his hard-lipped smile.
"Your lover does not know," he said. "You have not told him."
"Mande?"
"Tu amado no lo sabe."
"No,"
she whispered.
"Él no lo sabe."
He set out the pieces loosely on the board and swiveled it about. "I'll go you one more," he said. Mac shook his head. He held the cigar and blew smoke slowly over the table and then picked up his cup and drained the last of his coffee.
"I'm done," he said.
"Yes, sir.
You played a good game."
"I didn't believe you'd sacrifice a bishop."
"That was one of Schoenberger's gambits."
"You read a lot of chess books?"
"No, sir. Not a lot. I read his."
"You told me you played poker."
"Some,
Yes, sir.
Why do I think that means something else? Why, I never played that much poker. My daddy was a poker player. He always said that the problem with poker was you played with two kinds of money. What you won was gravy, but what you lost was hard come by. Was he a good poker player? Yes, sir, he was one of the best, I reckon. He cautioned me away from it, though. He said it was not any kind of a life. Why did he do it if he thought that? It was the only other thing he was good at. What was the first thing? He was a cowboy. I take it he was pretty good at that. Yes, sir. I've heard of some that was supposed to be better, and I'm sure there were some better. I just never did see any of them. He was on the death march, wasn't he? Yes, sir. There was a lot of boys from this part of the country was on it. Quite a few of them Mexicans. Yes, sir, there was. Mac pulled at his cigar and blew the smoke toward the window. Has Billy come around, or are you and him still on the outs? He's all right. Is he still going to stand up for you? Yes, sir. Mac nodded. She ain't got nobody to stand on her side? No, sir. Socorro is bringing her family. That's good. I ain't been in my suit in 3 years. I'd better make a dry run in it, I reckon. John Grady put the last of the pieces in the box and fitted and slit shut the wooden lid. Might need Socorro to let out the britches for me. They sat. Mac smoked. You ain't Catholic, are you? He said. No, sir. I won't need to make no disclaimers or nothing? No, sir. So Tuesday's the day? Yes, sir, February 17th. It's the last day before Lent, or I guess next to last. After that, you can't get married till Easter. Is that cutting it kindly close? It'll be all right. Mac nodded. He put the cigar in his teeth and pushed back the chair. Wait here a minute, he said. John Grady listened to him, going down the hall to his room. When he came back, he sat down and placed a gold ring on the table. That's been in my dresser drawer for 3 years. It ain't doing nobody any good there, and it never will. We talked about everything, and we talked about that ring. She didn't want it put in the ground. I want you to take it. Sir, I don't think I can do that. Yes, you can. I've already thought of everything you could possibly say on the subject, so rather than go over it item by item, let's just save the aggravation and you put it in your pocket and come Tuesday you put it on that girl's finger. You might need to get it resized. The woman that wore it was a beautiful woman. You can ask anybody, it wasn't just my opinion. But what you saw wouldn't hold a candle to what was on the inside. We would like to have had children, but we didn't. It damn sure wasn't from not trying. She was a woman with an awful lot of common sense. I thought she just wanted me to keep that ring for a remembrance, but she said I'd know what to do with it when the time come, and of course she was right. She was right about everything. And there's no pride in it when I tell you that she set more store by that ring and what it meant than anything else she ever owned, and that includes some pretty damn fine horses. So take it and put it in your pocket, and don't be arguing with me about everything.
Yes, sir.
And now I'm going to bed.
Yes, sir.
Good night.
Good night.
From the pass in the upper range of the Harias, they could see the green of the benchland below the springs, and they could see the thin standing spire of smoke from the fire in the stove rising vertically in the still blue morning air. They sat their horses. Billy nodded at the scene. When I was a kid, growing up in the Boot Heel, me and my brother used to stop where we topped out on this bench south of the ranch, going up into the mountains, and we'd look back down at the house. It would be snowing sometimes, or snow on the ground in the winter, and there was always a fire in the stove, and you could see the smoke from the chimney, and it was a long ways away, and it looked different from up there. Always looked different. It was different. We'd be gone up in the mountains sometimes all day throwing them spooky cattle out of the draws and bringing them down to the feed station where we'd put out cake. I don't think there ever was a time we didn't stop and look back that way before we rode up into that country. From where we'd stopped, we were not an hour away, and the coffee was still hot on the stove down there, but it was worlds away. Worlds away. In the distance, they could see the thin, straight line of the highway and a toy-sized truck running silently upon it. Beyond that, the green line of the river breaks, and range on range the distant mountains of Mexico. Billy watched him.
You think you'll ever go back there?
Where?
Mexico.
I don't know. I'd like to. You?
I don't think so. I think I'm done.
I came out of there on the run, riding at night, afraid to make a fire.
Been shot?
Been shot. Those people would take you in, hide you out, lie for you. No one ever asked me what it was I'd done.
Billy sat with his hands crossed palm down on the pommel of his saddle. He leaned and spat.
I went down there 3 separate trips. I never once came back with what I started after.
John Grady nodded.
What would you do if you couldn't be a cowboy?
I don't know. I reckon I'd think of something. You?
I don't know what it would be I'd think of.
Well, we may all have to think of something.
Yeah.
You think you could live in Mexico?
Yeah, probably.
Billy nodded.
You know what a vaquero makes in the way of wages?
Yeah.
You might luck up on a job as foreman or something, but sooner or later they're going to run all the white people out of that country. Even the Bobby Cota won't survive.
I know it.
You'd go to veterinary school if you had the money, I reckon, wouldn't you?
Yep, I would.
You ever write to your mother?
What's my mother got to do with anything?
Nothing. I just wonder if you even know what an outlaw you are.
Why?
Why do I wonder it?
Why am I an outlaw?
I don't know. You just got an outlaw heart. I've seen it before.
Because I said I could live in Mexico?
It ain't just that.
Don't you think if there's anything left of this life, it's down there?
Maybe.
You like it too?
Yeah? I don't even know what this life is. I damn sure don't know what Mexico is.
I think it's in your head.
Mexico. I rode a lot of ground down there. The first ranchero you hear sung, you understand the whole country. By the time you've heard 100, you don't know nothing. You never will. I concluded my business down there a long time ago.
He hooked his leg over the pommel of the saddle and sat, rolling a cigarette. They had dropped the reins, and the horses leaned and picked bleakly at the sparse tufts of grass trembling in the wind coming through the gap. He bent with his back to the wind and popped a match with his thumbnail and lit the cigarette and turned back.
I ain't the only one. It's another world. Everybody I ever knew that ever went back was going after something, or thought they was.
Yeah.
There's a difference between quitting and knowing when you're beat.
John Grady nodded.
I guess you don't believe that, do you?
John Grady studied the distant mountains.
No, he said, I guess I don't.
They sat for a long time. The wind blew. Billy had long since finished his cigarette and stubbed it out on the sole of his boot. He unfolded his leg back over the horn of the saddle and slid his boot into the stirrup and leaned down and took up the reins. The horses stepped and stood.
My daddy once told me that some of the most miserable people he ever knew were the ones that finally got what they'd always wanted.
Well, said John Grady, I'm willing to risk it. I've damn sure tried it the other way.
Yeah.
You can't tell anybody anything, bud. Hell, it's really just a way of telling yourself. And you can't even do that. You just try and use your best judgment, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Well, the world don't know nothing about your judgment.
I know it.
It's worse than that, even. It don't care.
Quinquagesima Sunday, in the pre-dawn dark, she lit a candle and set the candle dish on the floor beside the bureau where the light would not show beneath the doorway to the outer hall.
She washed herself at the sink with soap and cloth, and she leaned and let her black hair fall before her and passed the wet cloth the length of it 50 times and brushed it as many more. She poured a frugal few drops of scent onto her palm and pressed her palms together and scented her hair and the nape of her neck. Then she gathered her hair and twisted it into a rope and coiled and pinned it up. She dressed with care in one of the 3 street dresses she owned and stood regarding herself in the dimly lit mirror. The dress was navy blue with white bands at the collar and sleeves, and she turned in the mirror and reached over her shoulder and fastened the topmost buttons and turned again. She sat in the chair and pulled on the black pump shoes and stood and went to the bureau and got her purse and put into it the few toilet articles it would hold.
No koha nada, she whispered.
She folded in her clean underwear and her brush and combs and forced the catch shut.
No koha nada.
She took her sweater from the back of the chair and pulled it over her shoulders and turned to look at the room she would never see again. The crude carved santo stood as before, holding his staff so crookedly glued. She took a towel from the rack by the washstand, and she wrapped the santo in the towel, and then she sat in the chair with the santo in her lap and the purse hanging from her shoulder and waited. She waited a long time. She had no watch. She listened for the bells to toll in the distant town, but sometimes when the wind was coming in off the desert, you could not hear them. By and by, she heard a rooster call. Finally, she heard the slippered steps of the criada along the corridor, and she rose as the door opened and the old woman looked in on her and turned and looked back down the hallway and then entered with her hand fanned before her and one finger to her lips and pressed the door shut silently behind her.
¿Lista?
She hissed.
Sí, lista.
Bueno, vámonos.
The old woman gave a hitch of her shoulder and a sort of half-jaunty cock of her head. Some powdered stepdam from a storybook, some ragged conspiratress gesturing upon the boards. The girl clutched her purse and stood and put the santo under her arm, and the old woman opened the door and peered out and then urged her forward with her hand, and they stepped out into the hallway. Her shoes clicked on the tiles. The old woman looked down, and the girl bent slightly and raised her feet, each in turn, and slipped off the shoes and tucked them under her arm along with the santo. The old woman shut the door behind them, and they moved down the hallway, the crone holding her hand like a child's and tugging at her apron to sort forth her keys where they hung by their thong from the piece of broom handle. At the outer door, she stood and put her shoes on again, while the old woman muffled the heavy latch with her rebozo and turned it with her key. Then the door opened onto the cold and the dark. They stood facing one another.
Rápido, rápido,
whispered the old woman, and the girl pressed the money that she had promised into her hands and then threw her arms around her neck and kissed her dry and leather cheek and turned and stepped through the door. On the step she turned to take the old woman's blessing, but the criada was too distraught to respond, and before she could step away from out of the doorway light, the old woman had reached and seized her arm.
No te vayas, she hissed. No te vayas.
The girl tore her arm away from the old woman's grip. The sleeve of her dress ripped loose along the shoulder seam.
No,
she whispered, backing away.
No.
The old woman held out one hand. She called hoarsely after her.
No te vayas, she called. Me equivoqué.
The girl clutched her santo and her purse and went down the alleyway. Before she reached the end, she turned and looked back a last time. La tuerta was still standing in the door, watching her, holding the clutch of pesos to her breast. Then her eye blinked slowly in the light, and the door closed, and the key turned, and the bolt ran forever on that world. She went down the alleyway to the road and turned toward the town. Dogs were barking, and the air was smoky from the charcoal fires and the low mud hovels of the colonias. She walked along the sandy desert road, the stars in flood above her. The lower edges of the firmament sawed out into the black shapes of the mountains and the lights of the cities burning on the plain like stars pooled in a lake.
She sang to herself softly as she went a song from long ago. The dawn was 2 hours away. The town won. There were no cars on the road. From a rise, she could see, in the east, across the desert, 5 miles distant, the random lights of trucks moving slowly upon the highway that came up from Chihuahua. The air was still. She could see her breath in the dark. She watched the lights of a car that crossed from left to right somewhere before her, and she watched the lights move on. Somewhere out there in the world was Eduardo. When she reached the crossroads, she studied the distance in either direction for any sign of approaching car lights before she crossed. She kept to the narrow streets down through the barrios and the outlying precincts of the city. Already there were windows lit with oil lamps behind the walls of ocotillo or woven brush. She began to come upon occasional workmen with their lunches in lard cans they carried by the bale, whistling softly as they set forth in the early morning cold. Her feet were bleeding again in her shoes, and she could feel the wet blood and the coldness of it. The café held the only light along the Calle de Noche Triste. In the darkened window of the adjacent shoe store, a cat sat silently among the footwear watching the empty street. It turned its head to regard her as she passed. She pushed open the steamed glass door of the café and entered. Two men at a table by the window looked up when she came in and followed her with their eyes as she went by. She went to the rear and sat at one of the little wooden tables and put her purse and her parcel in the chair beside her and took up the menu from the chrome wire stand and sat looking at it. The waiter came over. She ordered a cafecito, and he nodded and went back to the counter. It was warm in the café, and after a while she took off the sweater and laid it in the chair. The men were still watching her. The waiter brought the coffee and set it before her with spoon and napkin. She was surprised to hear him ask where she was from.
"Mande?" she said.
"De donde viene?"
She told him she was from Chiapas, and he stood for a moment studying her, as if to see how such people might be different from those he knew. He said that he'd been told to ask by one of the men. When she turned and looked at them, they smiled, but there was no joy in it. She looked at the waiter.
"Estoy esperando a un amigo," she said.
"Por supuesto," said the waiter.
She sat over the coffee a long time. The street outside grew gray in the February dawn. The two men at the front of the café had long since finished their coffee and left, and others had come to take their place. The shops remained closed. A few trucks passed in the street, and people were coming in out of the cold, and a waitress was now going from table to table.
This ends Disc 6, Cities of the Plain, Disc 7.
Shortly after 7, a blue taxi pulled up at the door, and the driver got out and came in and canvassed the tables with his eyes. He came to the rear of the café and looked down at her.
"Lista," he said.
"Donde está Ramón?"
He stood, picking at his teeth reflectively. He said that Ramón could not come. She looked toward the front of the café. The cab stood in the street with the engine running in the cold.
"Está bien," said the driver. "Vámonos. Debemos darnos prisa."
She asked him if he knew John Grady, and he nodded and waved the toothpick.
"Sí, sí," he said.
He said that he knew everyone. She looked again at the cab smoking in the street. He had stepped back to allow her to rise. He looked down at the chair where she'd put her purse, the santo wrapped in the whorehouse towel. She placed her hand over these things, which he might wish to carry for her. She asked him who it was who had paid him. He put the toothpick back in his mouth and stood looking at her. Finally, he said that he had not been paid. He said that he was cousin to Ramón and that Ramón had been paid $40. He put his hand on the back of the empty chair and stood down looking at her. Her shoulders were rising and falling with her breath, like someone about to attempt a feat of strength. She said that she did not know. He leaned down.
Mire, he said, su novio. Él tiene una cicatriz aquí.
He passed his forefinger across his cheek to trace the path of the knife that had made the scar her lover carried from the fight 3 years ago in the comedor of the cárcel at Cuellar in the city of Saltillo.
¿Verdad? He said.
Sí,
she whispered.
¿Es verdad? ¿Y tiene mi tarjeta verde?
Sí.
He took the green card from his pocket and placed it on the table. On the card was printed her name.
¿Está satisfecha? He said.
Sí, she whispered. Estoy satisfecha.
And rose and gathered up her things and left money on the table to pay for the coffee and followed him out into the street. In the cold dawn, all that half-sordid world was coming to light again, and as she rode in silence in the rear of the cab through the waking streets, she clutched the ill-carved wooden relic and said a silent goodbye to everything she knew and to each thing she would not see again. She said goodbye to an old woman in a black rebozo come to a door to see what sort of day it was, and she said goodbye to three girls her age stepping with care around the water standing in the street from the recent rains who were on their way to mass, and she said goodbye to dogs and to old men at street corners and to vendors pushing their carts through the street to commence their day and to shopkeepers opening their doors and to the women who knelt with pail and rag to wash the walkway tiles. She said goodbye to the small birds strung shoulder to shoulder along the light wires overhead, who had slept and were waking, and whose name she would never know. They passed through the outskirts of the city, and she could see the river to the left through the river trees, and the tall buildings of the city beyond that were in another country, and the barren mountains where the sun would soon fall upon the rocks. They passed the old abandoned municipal buildings, rusted water tanks in a yard strewn with trash papers the wind had left, the sudden thin iron palings of a fence that ratcheted silently past the window from right to left, and which in their passing and in the period of their passing began to evoke the dormant sorcerer within before she could tear her gaze away. She put her hands to her eyes, breathing deeply. In the darkness inside the cups of her palms, she saw herself on a cold white table in a cold white room. The glass of the doors and the windows to that room were meshed with heavy wire, and clamoring there were whores and whores' handmaids, many in number, and all crying out to her. She sat upright on the table and threw back her head as if she would cry out or as if she would sing, like some young diva remanded to a madhouse. No sound came. The cold pneuma passed. She should have called it back. When she opened her eyes, the cab had turned off the road and was jostling over a bare dirt track, and the driver was watching her in the mirror. She looked out, but she could not see the bridge. She could see the river through the trees and the mist coming off the river and the raw rock mountains beyond, but she could not see the city. She saw a figure moving among the trees by the river. She asked the driver if they were to cross here to the other side, and he said yes. He said that she would be going to the other side now. Then the cab pulled into the clearing and came to a stop, and when she looked, what she saw coming toward her across the clearing in the earliest light of morning was the smiling Tiburcio. He had left the ranch around 5 and driven to the darkened front of the bar where he could see the dimly lit face of the clock within. He backed the truck around on the gravel apron so that he could watch the road, and he tried not to turn around to look at the clock every few minutes, but he did. Few cars passed. Shortly after 6 o'clock, a set of headlights slowed, and he sat upright over the steering wheel and cleared the glass with the forearm of his jacket. But the lights went past, and the car was not a taxi but a sheriff's prowl car. He thought they might come back and ask him what he was doing there, but they didn't. It was very cold sitting in the truck, and after a while he got out and walked around and flailed at himself with his arms and stamped his boots. Then he got back in the truck. The bar clock said 6:30. When he looked to the east, he could see the gray shape of the landscape. The lights of the gas station a half mile down the highway went out. A truck went down the highway.
He wondered if he could drive down there and get a cup of coffee before the cab arrived. By 8:30, he had decided that if that was what it would take to make the cab arrive, then that's what he would do, and he started the engine. Then he shut it off again. A half hour later, he saw Travis's truck go by on the highway. In a few minutes, it came back and slowed and pulled into the parking lot. John Grady rolled down the truck window. Travis pulled up and sat looking at him. He leaned and spat.
What did they do, give you your time?
Not yet.
I thought maybe the truck was stole. You ain't broke down, are you?
No, I was just waiting on somebody.
How long you been here?
I've been here a while.
Has that thing got a heater in it?
Not much of a one. Travis shook his head. He looked toward the highway. John Grady leaned and cleared the glass again with his sleeve.
I better get on, he said. Are you in some kind of trouble?
Yeah, maybe.
Over a girl, I reckon.
Yeah.
They ain't worth it, son.
I've heard that.
Well, don't do nothing dumb.
It's probably too late.
It ain't too late if you ain't done it.
I'm all right. He reached and turned the key and pushed the starter button. He turned and looked at Travis. I'll see you, he said. He pulled out of the parking lot and headed back up the highway. Travis sat watching the truck until it was out of sight. Four. When he got to the café in the Calle de Noche Triste, the place was full and the girl was hurrying back and forth with orders of eggs and baskets of tortillas. She didn't know anything. She'd only come to work an hour ago. He followed her into the kitchen. The cook looked up from the stove and looked at the girl.
¿Quién es?
He said. The girl shrugged. She looked at John Grady. She balanced plates up her arm and pushed back out through the door. The cook didn't know anything. He said the waiter's name was Felipe, but he wasn't here. He wouldn't be back until late afternoon. John Grady watched him for a few minutes while he turned the tortillas on the grill with his fingers. Then he pushed open the door and went back out through the restaurant. He followed the trail of the cab driver through the various side street bars where he plied his trade. Bars where patrons from the prior night clutched their drinks and squinted in the light from the opening door like suspects under interrogation. He narrowly avoided two fights for refusing to accept a drink. He went to the Venada and knocked at the door, but no one came. He stood outside the Moderno, peering into the interior, but all was closed and dark. He went to the pool hall in Mariscal Street that was frequented by the musicians and where their instruments hung along the wall, guitars and mandolins and horns of brass or German silver, a Mexican harp. He asked after the maestro, but none had seen him. By noon, he had nowhere else to go but to the White Lake. He sat in a cafe over a cup of black coffee. He sat a long time. There was another place to go, but he didn't want to go there either. A dwarf of a man in a white coat led him down a corridor. The building smelled of damp concrete. Outside, he could hear street traffic, a jackhammer. The man pushed through a door at the end of the corridor and held the door and nodded him through and then reached and threw the light switch. The boy took off his hat. They stood in a room where the recent dead, four in number, lay on their cooling boards. The boards were trestled up on legs made from plumbing pipe, and the dead lay upon them with their hands at their sides and their eyes closed and their necks in dark, stained wooden chocks. None were covered over, but all lay in their clothes as death had found them. They had the look of rumpled travelers resting in an anteroom. He walked along slowly past the tables. The overhead ceiling lights were covered with small wire baskets. The walls were painted green. In the floor, a brass drain. Bits of gray mop string twisted about the castered wheels under the tables. The girl to whom he'd sworn his love forever lay on the last table. She lay as the rush cutters had found her that morning in the shallows under the shore willows with the mist rising off the river. her hair damp and matted, so black, hung with strands of dead brown weed, her face so pale, the severed throat gaping bloodlessly. Her good blue dress was twisted about on her body and her stockings were torn. She'd lost her shoes. There was no blood, for it had all washed away. He reached and touched her cheek. "Oh, God," he said.
"La conoce?" said the orderly.
"Oh, God.
La conoce?"
He leaned on the table, crushing his hat. He put his hand across his eyes, gripping his skull. Had he the strength, he'd have crushed out all it held. What lay before him now and all else it might hold forever.
"Señor," said the orderly, but the boy turned and pushed past him and stumbled out.
The man called after him. He stood in the door and called down the hallway. He said that if he knew this girl, he must make an identification. He said that there were papers to be filled out. The cattle in the long Cedar Springs draw up through which he rode studied him as they stood chewing and then lowered their heads again. The rider knew they could tell his intentions by the attitude of the horse he rode. He passed on and rode up into the hills and crested out on the mesa and rode slowly along the rim. He sat the horse facing into the wind and watched the train going up the valley 15 miles away. To the south, the thin green line of the river lay like a child's crayon mark across that mauve and bistre waste. Beyond that, the mountains of Mexico in paling blues and grays washing out in the distance. The grass along the mesa underfoot twisted in the wind. A dark head of weather was making up to the north. The little horse dipped its head, and he pulled it about and rode on. The horse seemed uncertain and looked off to the west, as if to remember the way. The boy booted him forward.
"You don't need to worry about it," he said.
He crossed the highway and crossed through the westernmost section of the McGregor Ranch. He rode through country he'd not seen before. In the early afternoon, he came upon a rider sitting his horse with his hands crossed loosely over the pommel of his saddle. The horse was a good-looking black gelding with a savvy look to its eye. It was ochred to the knees from the dust of that country, and the rig was an old rimfire outfit with Visalia stirrups and a flat saddle horn the size of a coffee saucer. The rider was chewing tobacco, and he nodded as John Grady rode up.
"Can I help you?"
he said. John Grady leaned and spat.
"Meaning I ain't supposed to be on your land," he said.
He looked at the rider, a man a few years older than he. The rider studied him back with his pale blue eyes.
"I work for Mac McGovern," John Grady said. "I reckon you know him."
"Yes," the rider said, "I know him."
"You all got stock drifted up this way?"
"No, not that I know of.
I just kindly drifted up this way myself."
The rider pushed the brim of his hat back slightly with his thumb. They were met upon a clay floodplain, bereft of grass or any growing thing, and the only sound the wind made was in their clothes. The dark clouds stood banked in a high wall to the north, and a thin and soundless wire of lightning appeared there and quivered and vanished again. The rider leaned and spat and waited.
"I was supposed to get married in 2 days' time," the boy said.
The rider nodded, but the boy said no more.
"I take it you changed your mind."
The boy didn't answer. The rider looked off to the north and looked back again.
"We might get some rain out of that."
"We might.
It's rained over in town the last 2 nights.
Have you had your dinner?"
"No, I guess I ain't."
"Why don't you come on to the house?"
"I better get on back."
"I reckon she changed hers." The boy looked away. He didn't answer.
"There'll be another in along directly, you'll see."
"No, there won't."
Why don't you come on to the house and take dinner with us? I appreciate it. I need to get back. You remind me some of myself. Get something on your mind and just ride.
John Grady sat, loosely holding the reins. He looked a long time out at the running country before he spoke. When he did speak, the rider had to lean to catch his words.
I wish I could ride, he said. I wish I could.
The rider wiped the corners of his mouth with the heel of his thumb.
Maybe you'd better ought not to go back just yet, he said. Maybe you ought to just wait a little while.
I'd ride and I'd never look back. I'd ride to where I couldn't find a single day I ever knew. Even if I was to turn back and ride over every foot of that ground, then I'd ride some more.
I've been that way, said the rider.
I better get on.
You sure you won't change your mind? We feed pretty good.
No, I thank you.
Well, I hope you get that rain up here.
I appreciate it. He turned the horse and set out south down the broad floodplain. The rider turned his own horse and started back up country, but he stopped before he'd gone far. He sat the horse and watched the boy riding out down the broad valley, and he watched him for a long time. When he could see him no more, he raised himself slightly in the stirrups, as if he might call after him. The boy never looked back. When he was gone, the rider stayed a while yet. He had dropped the reins, and he sat with one leg crossed over the fork of the saddle, and he pushed back his hat and leaned and spat and studied the country, as if it ought to have something to tell him for that figure having passed through it. It was late evening and almost dark.